This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices, episode 209, was recorded on March 5th, 2020. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode of Macro Voices is brought to you by TopTradersUnplugged.com, a podcast dedicated to quant and rules-based investing, helping investors overcome behavioral biases. Former hedge fund manager Jesse Felder, founder and editor of The Felder Report, returns to join me as this week's feature interview guest. We'll discuss why Jesse thinks the COVID-19 coronavirus was just the catalyst that brought about an already overdue change of direction for equity markets. We'll also discuss the value plays that Jesse still sees in this market and his overall macro outlook. In our post-game segment this week, Patrick is back with another of his famous post-game chart books. And a quick housekeeping note, Macro Voices will be released one day early next week on Wednesday, March 11th, in order to accommodate travel schedules.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, I'm dying to get into talking about the markets, but before we do, why don't you give us a quick update on what's going on with the coronavirus story?
Well, Patrick, we already did a coronavirus episode this week that aired on Monday. It featured a repeat, a rebroadcast of our January 30th interview with Dr. Chris Martinson, plus a full 25-minute update from me on new developments since January. You'll find that podcast on our homepage at macrovoices.com. So I'm just going to focus on what's new since then. We do have confirmation now of a mutation of the virus, something Dr. Chris Martinson has been predicting for more than a month. So now they call it type L and type S. Type L is the type from Wuhan, the more aggressive type, and also the more common type. I don't think there's any really profound importance to the fact that this mutation has occurred, other than perhaps for the fact that it maybe explains. You know, for a while we're saying, boy, it doesn't seem to make sense. Some areas we're seeing these doubling times that are running 7 or 8 days, and they're getting things under control. Other areas, the doubling times are running just 3 or 4 days, and it's being much harder to control it. How come Singapore is different from Daegu, South Korea? Could be that they were facing different strains of the virus, and that's the reason that they had different experiences. That's just speculation on my part. We don't know that yet, but we do know that there's two strains of the virus. The other thing that's become even more clear is it's not just China that's lying about the numbers. Italy has followed China's lead. They're now excluding asymptomatic positives from their reporting. So, in other words, you get the PCR swab test that proves that you are positive. You are infected with the SARS-CoV-2 virus that causes COVID-19. That means you're contagious and endangering the people around you, and you don't get counted as a test case because, well, it's not convenient to have a whole lot of cases if you're in the tourist business, I guess. It really makes no logical sense, but China was the first to do that. Now Italy has done it. I won't be surprised if a lot of other countries do the same thing. Meanwhile, quite a few people, Ben Hunt and myself included, have been very critical of the CDC for the fact that by the admission of their own website, they've only conducted a grand total of 472 PCR tests for COVID-19 to date. Meanwhile, the much smaller nation of South Korea has conducted over 100,000 tests and has even implemented the convenience of drive-through testing, where you drive up, they do the swab, they take the test, and you automatically get your test results via an SMS text message. Meanwhile, the CDC has only done 472 tests nationwide. Apparently, they're listening. They have responded by removing the number of tests that they have actually performed from their website. So now it's a secret. We don't know how many tests they have conducted, but not enough. Quite a few states are responding, including New York, in great frustration, saying, look, we're going to figure out how to do our own testing. We're not going to wait for the federal government to get its act together. Meanwhile, Europe is exploding in in just the last couple of days, particularly. Now, what I did is just to take the countries of France, Spain, Germany, Norway, and Italy. Why just those five countries? Because if I'd done all the countries, it would have made a bigger spreadsheet, and I didn't have time to do that. So I just took a handful of them. And I looked at how many cases do we now have. First of all, it's more than 5,000 as of this afternoon, Thursday. It was just a few hundred last week. If I look at that and I just take the rate of exponential growth, which is occurring in those countries over the last couple of days, and I project that forward into the future, if I use that rate of growth at the current rate of exponential growth, just those five countries alone, not all of Europe, but just those five countries, 1 week from now on March 12th, would be projected to have 27,600 cases. 2 weeks from now on March 19th, 239 cases. 3 weeks from now on March 26th, 2.8 million cases. Now, that's not going to happen. It's not a forecast. It's not what I think is going to happen, because long before you got to 2.8 million cases, people will change their behavior. They will implement self-quarantines. There will be government quarantines. There will be a very different set of behavior that will mitigate the spread of the virus. So the next thing I did is I said, okay, let's look at just Italy, which is a bit farther along. They know they've got a really serious problem. They're already taking these containment measures, and that has indeed slowed down that rate of exponential growth, where some of those countries were showing 43 to 48% daily growth rates. Italy's only showing 19. So I said, okay, let's assume that everybody else is going to slow down to that 19.5% actually is the number. What do I get then? 1 week from now, 15,000 cases in those five countries alone. 2 weeks from now, 54,000 cases. 3 weeks from now, 189,000 cases across Europe. And I do think that second set of numbers are actually realistic. Folks, this is not priced in. And again, the reason that I only chose those countries is because I was trying to keep it simple. We meanwhile have some other countries like Belgium, their case count doubled overnight last night. So it's really breaking in Europe. Seattle isn't far behind, and we're just starting to get the beginnings of a breakout in New York State. So I think the rest of the United States, maybe give it a week or two before we have breakouts all across the United States, and this is not priced in, folks. We are just at the tip of the iceberg. And meanwhile, on Twitter today, I'm getting beaten up by people who are telling me, why don't you read the news? It's just the flu. It's not a big deal. People, it's not just the flu. It is a big deal, and it is not priced into markets. I stand by my previous conviction, Patrick. This is the biggest mispricing of risk in maybe the history of financial markets, certainly since the subprime debacle more than a decade ago.
All right, Eric, let's get to the S&P 500, because as soon as we ended recording last show, we were very close to a trading low. And really, in the last few days, all we've really seen was an S&P 500 that's backfilled that very oversold state. I mean, we had a couple hundred S&P points off the low, and we're giving it back now. I mean, we're back pretty much at 3,000 at the time when we're recording here. What's your take on all of this? I mean, I'm thinking that the market has another leg lower coming, but what's your take?
Oh, that's an understatement. But let's start, Patrick, with what actually happened here, because I don't think it's as clear as it usually is. First of all, we got a gap down open on the futures open on Sunday evening because there had not been a widely anticipated emergency move from the Federal Reserve over the weekend. A lot of people thought it was going to come on Sunday afternoon or something like that. Didn't happen. Gap down open. Then we had Bank of Japan and Royal Bank of Australia both announced, and this was on Sunday evening, which would be Monday morning their time, both of those central banks announced stimulus. And that caused people to say, wait a minute, this is probably coordinated with the Fed. Probably the Fed is about to make their own announcement. All of a sudden, we had this big rally all through Monday and into Tuesday morning. Then came the Fed's announcement of an emergency 50 basis point cut in interest rates mid-morning on Tuesday, exactly as I predicted that they would do. And exactly as I planned, I sold that top as quickly as I could, buying as many puts and short futures contracts as I could possibly justify from a risk management standpoint, and that so far has proved out to be exactly the right call. Now, from there, we went straight down on a loss of confidence. I expected that, but I didn't expect it nearly so quickly. I thought we'd rally up for a couple more days after the Fed announcement until people figured out that you can't cure a virus for which no vaccine exists using printed money. It took the crude oil market less than 30 seconds to start reversing after that announcement. It took stocks maybe a half an hour, but very, very short-lived. And boy, things were really, really headed south on Tuesday afternoon. The big rally overnight Tuesday is being ascribed by most commentators to the Biden win on Super Tuesday. The logic is people think Bernie Sanders as president will be very bad for the stock market. Biden winning all of those states looks much more likely that Sanders is not going to be the Democratic nominee. People think that's good for stocks. That helped the rally. Now, most people say that's the whole reason for the rally. I think if you read the fine print on Tuesday's news, oh, by the way, the Federal Reserve also injected another $200 billion into the repo market on Tuesday evening. I guess they figured out that their 50 basis point cut wasn't enough, and they continued stimulating into the Tuesday night repo market. And hey, you know, $100 billion here, $100 billion there, before you know it, it adds up to real money. Further extension of the upside was when both Bloomberg and then later Liz Warren dropped out of the presidential race. That took us up, but not quite as high as that blow-off top that we had on the Fed's 50 basis point cut announcement. So my take, Patrick, is the most amazing part of this is the market is obviously much more concerned about whether it's Bernie versus Joe Biden than they are about the fact that a global viral pandemic is about to lead to potentially a 2008-size financial crisis. So it's amazing to me that the market has not really tuned in yet to coronavirus risk, although I think that this explosive case growth in Europe will probably be what changes that in coming days. Now, ironically, Patrick, I personally think that if anything, Bernie's chances are much better now, not worse. And this is obviously a non-consensus view, but the way I see this, President Trump couldn't really have screwed up this COVID-19 coronavirus story any worse than he has. It would have been so easy for him to just say, hey, it wasn't my fault, but the economy is strong. We're going to get through this together. Let's work together as Americans. He didn't do that. He told everybody that it is not a big deal. And he actually, in that press conference, he specifically said the words that the regular seasonal flu has a much higher case fatality rate. And that is just plain wrong. In reality, COVID-19, or more accurately, SARS-CoV-2, which is the virus that causes COVID-19, has a case fatality rate 28 times higher than the seasonal flu. You know that's going to be in the political commercials when we get into election season. The Democrats are going to have a field day with this. I'm amazed people are saying, oh, this is Trump's Katrina. Well, wait a minute. In Hurricane Katrina, President Bush screwed up really badly, but he never called a press conference from the Oval Office and told the entire nation, quit your whining, guys. It's just a windy day. It's not a big deal. President Trump told everybody it's just the flu, it's not a big deal, and I don't think he's ever going to live that down. Enter Bernie Sanders, Mr. Free Healthcare for Everybody. If you have somebody that you know who is hospitalized in critical condition at election time because of the COVID-19 outbreak, which will occur across the United States, it's not going to affect everybody, but everybody's going to know somebody who was affected by it. And you got Bernie saying, hey, had I been elected in 2016, every American would have free healthcare and nobody would be at risk. Of course, there's logical fallacies to that, but they'll buy it. So I previously thought that Trump had at least an 80% chance of being reelected. I think now he has a 20% chance of being reelected if the COVID-19 pandemic goes down the way that I expect it to. So he really screwed himself with that very specific comment that was just plain wrong about fatality rates. So I think, Patrick, that the next couple of weeks will be very telling. But as Europe, Seattle, and particularly New York, because if it starts starts to feel close to home for professional traders in New York City. All of a sudden, emotion takes over and people start to panic. I think COVID-19 is just about to hit the tape again and hit it hard. And I think we ain't seen nothing yet. I think the big downside that everybody is saying the bottom is in and that was it, I think that was just dress rehearsal for the main event, which has yet to occur.
Well, I'm looking forward to talking about it in further detail when we pull up the chart book in the post game. But let's keep moving on for now to the dollar index, because I'm actually quite shocked how much of a pop and drop we've seen in that dollar, and where it looked like for a moment a couple weeks ago, the dollar was going to be ripping above 100 handle on the Dixie. And now we've given it all back and we're back to December and January lows. What's your take on the dollar index here?
Well, first thing, just in the interest of good journalism and integrity, which I pride myself on, is I got this thing just plain old-fashioned wrong. And I couldn't have been more wrong about what was going to go on with the dollar. So therefore, I have to discount the value of my own opinion for what's going to happen next. Now, you could easily dismiss this and say, look, the Fed just made a 50 basis point panic emergency cut that's causing a loss of confidence in the dollar. It's no surprise that it's crashing. Well, you know, that sort of logically makes sense if you're trying to make up a narrative to explain why I got it so badly wrong. I guess that sort of fits the bill. But frankly, other central banks led with their cuts before the Fed. Other central banks beyond the ones that have already cut are likely to follow. And I think the reason that all of this is happening, Patrick, is because everybody is starting to wake up to the fact that this global pandemic is a really, really big deal, and it's going to cause an economic slowdown on the scale of 2008. Now, if that's right, it really ought to be, as far as I'm concerned, very bullish, the dollar. The dollar should be strong here. The opposite is happening. I'm just wrong for now, and I suppose it's possible that everybody is, you know, loss of confidence because of the 50 basis point cut. We're going to have a knee-jerk down, and then the market is going to figure out that the reason this is all happening really is dollar bullish, and it's all going to go uphill from here. Sounds good, but frankly, I'm not willing to bet on it myself. I got this wrong. I'm going to put myself in the penalty box until I'm sure I have it figured out.
All right, well, let's move on to crude oil. Every rally is being faded. I mean, crude oil can't stick to any upside, and it just continues to gravitate. I mean, we printed down below 44 for a little while, and it looks like we're heading right back there. What's your take on what's happening in crude?
Well, what really, really struck me this week, Patrick, was I was expecting the Fed announcement. I didn't know when it was going to happen. I was expecting it to be 50 basis points, and I expected it to take us right up to the 13-day moving average, to the top of this correction range. We didn't even get back to the previous high of the day, and we didn't even get back to the 8-day moving average. It topped out, and not only that, but that pop that we got on the Fed rate cut literally just lasted less than 30 seconds. All of a sudden, it was retracing. Fortunately, I was quick. I was sitting there when it happened. I said, boy, this is topping out sooner than I thought. And I changed my limit orders to market orders and went ahead and filled the rest of my puts. So I loaded up on puts right at the top there when the Fed announcement occurred, and I'm glad that I did. Now, since then, what's been really driving the tape after the Fed, and all of that got retraced right back out, is OPEC. There's two stories to tell here. One is what really happened, and the other one is the one they made up for TV. What really happened is OPEC Plus, that's OPEC Plus Russia, had a meeting and said, we really need to cut production. Russia said no. And they said, well, but really, no, we really need to. And Russia said, what part of no don't you understand? And got up and left. Okay, that's pretty darn clear. Of course, what the spin doctors did is they said, well, let's take a vote now and we'll put out a press release that said OPEC Plus had a meeting and 100% of all countries in attendance agreed on a big production cut. Well, of course, all of the countries in attendance had agreed on a production cut because Russia just got up and walked out of the room because they're not willing to even discuss it any further. Really, really clear where Russia stands. But they tried to spin it, and what they did today, Patrick, is they announced that there is a OPEC-approved 1.5 million barrel production cut in Q2 of 2020 contingent, in the fine print, contingent on Russia's participation, which Russia has already said no to. For a while, I thought what was going to happen, Patrick, since the actual, this is the committee meeting where this happened, the final OPEC Plus meeting is not until tomorrow, Friday. I thought that we were going to be stuck between the 5 and 8 day moving averages until tomorrow's meeting, when Russia would show up and say no still means no, and the market was going to dump from there. That was my prediction. Turns out, as we're recording on Thursday mid-afternoon, we took out the 5 day moving average. We're headed straight down. I don't know if Russia told somebody not to expect anything tomorrow or if the market just figured it out, but they're not waiting for tomorrow's meeting. And I think that after tomorrow's meeting, when there's confirmation that no still means no from Russia, that we're going to see an acceleration to the downside. So I think that this correction in the middle of a very, very significant downtrend is over. And the next targets that I see from here, 45 spot 47 would be the next target. That's only about 20 cents lower than where we are as we're recording today. That's the 61.8% Fib retracement level of the big move up from the 2016 lows all the way to the October 2018 highs. Once the virus really hits the tape, though, which probably won't be till early next week, 42 spot 36 is a very important number. I want to get back to that in the postgame segment. I know you've got a weekly chart coming up. Next targets that I see are 39 spot 17, then 32, and then, of course, 26 spot 08, which was the low from 2016. And let's talk about that more in the postgame segment.
So, Eric, how did the inventory numbers come in this week, though?
Crude oil building 785,000 barrels, smaller build than expected. Cushing, Oklahoma, drawing down 2 million barrels. I'm not sure, quite sure what's going on in Cushing. Maybe there's less imports coming in from other places, and they're pipelining that oil out of Cushing. I'm not really sure on that one. Gasoline and distillates, though, both big drawdowns, 4.3 million barrels gasoline. Distillates drawing down 4 million barrels. U.S. production ticking up to a new all-time record of 13.1 million barrels. Tape action was, you know, in theory, you think you got a smaller than expected build and really big draws on finished products. That ought to be bullish. It was a little pop-up, lasted, I don't know, 10 minutes or something, and then it was all downhill from there. So I think that any hope of inventory saving this market from the fundamentals was misplaced.
All right, well, let's move on to gold, because on Friday, right after we finished recording, came that big slam day on the downside, and gold just goes ripping to the downside. One of the biggest down days we've seen in like over a year. And suddenly, you know, I'm thinking, like, is this all over? And then within days, we've completely reversed it. Once the 50 basis point cut came in, rallied right back to 1650, and we're almost making a fresh high. What's your take on all of this?
Patrick, I really, really want to talk gold this week. I think it's so incredibly important, especially because of what the lesson of this move down and move back up teaches us. I think we should probably save most of that for the post-game segment, because our listeners, frankly, are waiting to hear Jesse Felder, and this is already a long market wrap. But very briefly, what's going on here is the news that's happening is all super bullish for gold. The reason we had the sell-off that we had when we had it is because people, doesn't matter what the fundamentals are, if you're losing money hand over fist on your stock trades and you've got margin calls to meet, you got to sell whatever you've got in order to raise cash. That's what was pulling the price of gold down. Now we had the Fed rate cut. That's very bullish gold coming back up. I think what you just saw, that down and back up, was just a mini dress rehearsal for the exact same thing, which I think is going to happen again on a much larger scale. I think that we've got a lot of downside coming in gold, even though the events that are occurring are going to ultimately be super bullish. Let's save the conversation for that for the post-game segment, where we can go over the chart and really talk about what happened in 2008 and why I think that's a good template for what's about to happen next.
All right, well, let's get to the 10-year Treasury yield, because look, Eric, we've been both bullish bonds. I've made money on bonds. I was thinking yields were going to go lower, but oh my God, like, unbelievable. We are not only under 1%, I mean, we're 0.92 on the 10-year yield. It's unbelievable, this deflationary impulse that's being now priced in because of this coronavirus. How low do we go on this?
Well, Patrick, I mean, just think about how silly I sounded 2 weeks ago, just 2 weeks ago, when I said we're going below one spot 34, which, of course, Jeff Gundlach famously said would never go below ever again. And 1 week ago, I said, folks, sub 1%, it's coming on the 10-year. And people thought I sounded nuts. 1 week later, and we're there. Now, I got to check my chart here. Hang on a second. Okay, yeah. Okay, Patrick, we've still got a positive number on the 10-year. It's not negative yet. 0.92. I think that 50 basis points is very likely before the COVID-19 crisis is over. But I really have to qualify that. I haven't done any solid analysis or modeling or anything. I'm kind of pulling that off the top of my head just to say, folks, I think that big things are possible here. How big, you know, is it 50 basis points? Is it 25 basis points? I don't know. But there's plenty of room for a whole lot more panicking to happen that has yet to begin.
This week's featured interview guest is former hedge fund manager Jesse Felder. Now, why did we bring Jesse back this week?
Well, the reason for this week for Jesse is a really smart guy. He's been a voice of reason for the last few years, and he has, I think, made some very good arguments for, okay, it's not time yet, but when we get the catalyst, folks, watch out, because there's a lot of structural reasons to really think there could be a lot of downside in markets when the trend changes. Well, now we've got a catalyst, so I wanted to get Jesse on to talk about what those structural factors are. And he's saying, you know, he's not even that focused on the COVID-19 situation. He's just saying, okay, we got a catalyst. And he's going to talk to us mostly about the reasons why he thinks that just unleashes a number of factors that have been pent up in the market for years now. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by TopTradersUnplugged.com. In recent weeks, we've been reminded of the fragility of world financial markets and how quickly sentiment can shift from risk on to risk off. Once again, the mantra of buy the dip and the determination of central banks will be put to the test. But as Chris Cole recently told us, the best approach to investing in the long run is very different from what's worked best in recent decades. To help Macro Voices listeners navigate an uncertain future, Niels Kastrup-Larsen, host of the Top Traders Unplugged podcast, has created a guide to the best investment books of all time. You can get a free copy at toptradersunplugged.com/macro guide. And be sure to listen to my full-length interview with Niels Kastrup-Larsen on trend following. The download link is in your Research Roundup email. Check out toptradersunplugged.com today. You'll be glad you did.
Eric's interview with Jesse Felder is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Jesse Felder from The Felder Report, which without a doubt is one of the most popular subscription newsletters in the marketplace. Jesse, it's been way too long. It's great to get you back in the program. I want to start with the market because you have been a voice of reason for years now saying, hey, guys, you know, it's great that the stock market is making money for people, but it's 10 years straight up. You know, it's too much, too far, too fast. The question on my mind now, Jesse, obviously the COVID-19 situation is the proximal catalyst that's caused the recent selling. But is this the extent of what's going on, or is it more likely the case that COVID-19 is the catalyst that was needed to bring about a change in market direction that might have been overdue to start with?
Yeah, well, first, I just got to say thanks for having me back on, Eric. It's always an honor. You are by far one of my favorite podcasts to listen to, let alone, you know, have the opportunity to chat with you like this. But yeah, you know, this is kind of what extremely overvalued markets do, is you have these kind of periods where they continue to move higher, but then, you know, I guess we saw the fastest correction in history last week, and that's what they do, is they quickly give back those gains. We've essentially gone nowhere now since, you know, January of 2018. So it might feel like stocks have done, you know, really well over that period, but essentially we've spent a lot of time doing nothing. And I do think that this is probably the beginning of a larger bear market. And really what was astounding to me was to watch stocks really since, you know, August, September of last year soar to these new highs, despite you know, a lot of things that were becoming increasingly obvious and problematic for equities. I think, you know, I mentioned valuation extremes. This is the most extreme the stock market valuations have ever been in history. We're higher than the 29, higher than the 2000 peaks in valuation. And, you know, that's been the case for quite some time, that stocks have been expensive. But what we were starting to see early this year was we saw stock buybacks drop off dramatically. I think in January, we saw buyback activity announcements drop to $10 billion from an average of $50 billion over the last 4 or 5 years. And that amid earnings growth that was looking to be, you know, zero at best for this year. Outside of the FANG stocks, it's negative. And, you know, that is a big reason why buyback activity is not, you know, picking up or at least even sustaining, because, you know, earnings is dropping off and companies are just having to retrench. But we also saw the growing signs of recession, not, you know, not just the yield curve, which a lot of people have dismissed. But my friend Tom McClellan has shown that, you know, the yield curve is a good forward predictor of recession, but it leads by about 15 months. So the bottom of when the yield curve bottoms, you usually see a bottom in economic activity 15 months later, which would kind of put us into the fall of this year for weak economic activity or a bottom in economic activity. But that wasn't the only thing. I look at the Conference Board Leading Economic Index, and when that moves below its 18-month moving average, it's almost, I think every time, has been an indicator of recession a month or two later. That happened in December. We saw the leading economic index cross below its 18-month moving average. And then, of course, job openings numbers were horrible, even as the stock market was hitting new highs, kind of recessionary numbers. So these are all the things the stock market was kind of ignoring and kind of relying on this liquidity injection on the part of the Fed, which was, by some measures, the biggest liquidity injection we've ever seen in history. But even this, you look at the numbers, you know, they peaked in I think early February, and we're rolling over in terms of the amount of liquidity the Fed was providing, and markets were ignoring that. There was also deteriorating breadth in the market. One of the things that, you know, a blog post I put up, I think in mid-February, we saw another big cluster of Hindenburg omens, which is just a sign that there are a lot of stocks hitting new lows at the time the market was hitting a new high. And another way that kind of manifests was something I look at, I think Stan Druckenmiller called his, you know, economic predictors index, the best economic predictor he's seen in his career, are the relative performance of cyclically sensitive sectors. And you look at things that, you know, he's mentioned, you know, retail, metals and mining, and these types of sectors, the relative strength of these things were plunging from last fall into, you know, January, February this year, along with risk appetites, you know, people pouring money into utilities and other things. So the market was ignoring all of these signs of deteriorating fundamentals before the coronavirus came along and really played the catalyst.
Jesse, I want to pick up on what you said about Fed stimulus. I should let our listeners know we're recording this on Monday afternoon, a few days before you're going to hear it. So what's going on as we're speaking is the central bankers just came riding in like the cavalry to the rescue. Late Sunday night, the Bank of Japan, I think, was first to announce that they were going to launch stimulus, then the Royal Bank of Australia. So far, the Fed has only intimated that they're about to do something. Probably by the time our listeners hear this interview, they will have done something. And it's no surprise at all that markets are rebounding, because I think we have an entire generation of traders who have been conditioned to know that central bank stimulus always just seems to recover markets. But I kind of think, wait a minute, Jesse, hang on. The reason that central bank stimulus has been able to save the day in 2008 is that was a problem with the financial system itself. The credit market was melting down. They needed liquidity. This is a virus that there won't be a vaccine for a year. I don't see how central bank liquidity can do anything meaningful to actually address the problem. So how long do you think that this bounce, which I think is only beginning as we're speaking, how long do you think it lasts before maybe markets realize that you can't cure a virus with central bank money printing?
Well, you know, we clearly got oversold on Friday, and it looked like the markets were primed for a bounce, and they are bouncing now. And, you know, that does coincide with anticipation of some kind of coordinated stimulus. But you're absolutely right. I don't think that even a combination of fiscal and monetary support right now is going to be able to prevent recession. When you see, you know, what's going on in China in terms of quarantines, and you know, they've had the worst economic numbers coming out of China in history in some of these cases. And so, you know, the virus is now here in the United States, we're already seeing conferences canceled, air travel canceled, vacations canceled, you know, all this kind of stuff. And I think we were already seeing kind of, like I said before, signs pointing to recession. You know, the Fed cut rates dramatically in 2008. They did in 2001 also. And, you know, just weren't able to even prevent a recession in both of those situations. And this, as you point out, is even more difficult for central bankers to respond to. So I think a recession at this point is pretty much a slam dunk. And, you know, corporate earnings could be horrendously bad. We've seen a lot of American companies say that their earnings for China or sales in China for the whole year, for 2020, could be down by 50%. And, you know, and this is numbers that they were saying last week before we even know the extent of the economic damage in China. So, you know, if that's the case on their Chinese sales, and the impact here in the United States is even a fraction of what it is in China, we could see some really major declines in both sales and earnings for companies here. Where this becomes, I think, the most problematic is corporate leverage is off the charts. We've never seen corporate leverage as high as it is today. So there are a bunch of companies, you know, people have been highlighting companies in China that can't withstand, you know, the sort of sales declines that they're seeing and what is going on over there to try and prop these companies up. But I think, you know, we may have a similar situation here where we have companies that can't withstand the sort of sales declines they may see if people really start staying away from, you know, shopping centers and these types of things because they're afraid of contracting the virus. So I think that's where probably a coordinated fiscal monetary response would have to come in and provide tax credits and things to companies to try and float them through a difficult period. Because if this leverage, you know, now actually comes to, you know, become a problem, it could be this Minsky moment, I think, that a lot of credit investors have been warning about for a long time.
Jesse, before we even consider that there is a coronavirus, you, I think, have been pretty outspoken in recent months in saying, look, there has been so much euphoric buying that there's a lot of excess, a lot of froth built into the market. If coronavirus was just the catalyst to bring it out, how much froth is there to bring out? How much downside would you expect in order to take that recent froth out of the market?
Well, I think that's, you know, obviously the coronavirus was a catalyst for the selling, but a lot of it was just the natural unwinding of some of the most, you know, crazy euphoric buying in equities that we've seen in history. We saw Schwab go to free commissions and a bunch of its competitors follow kind of late last year. And that led to an explosion of trading at these companies. We haven't seen trading like this ever, even in the dot-com mania, where you have retail investors going crazy for equity trading. And a lot of people have said that's really what we're going to have to see before this bull market is over. And because we hadn't seen it yet, that the bull market wasn't over yet. And I guess those people were exactly right. But that is what we've seen over the last few months. We saw call buying activity in a lot of these, you know, big tech stocks like we've never seen before. I think Jason Gepford from Sentiment Trader had a good stat. The two-week period right before this crash, we saw 60% more call buying than ever before in history. It was just so massive. And, you know, as a lot of people have reported recently, that is kind of a self-fulfilling thing. And a lot of these trades came from, you know, Reddit kind of boards, internet boards. It reminds me of kind of the dot-com mania, where you had a lot of these traders basically decide, hey, if we all go buy tons of call options, it's going to force market makers who are going to be short calls to go in and buy the underlying equity to hedge against being short calls. And it kind of creates a self-fulfilling prophecy. We saw these kind of these crazy parabolic ramps in a number of stocks over the last 2 years, going back to Overstock during the Bitcoin bubble in late 17, early 18. And then it was Tilray, then Beyond Meat. Then more recently it was Tesla and Virgin Galactic, who, you know, these stocks just gained, you know, billions in value in a very, very short period of time. And it's that type of, you know, I guess, euphoric, manic buying that you only see kind of very near major stock market peaks. And then on top of all that, we saw the greatest net long in equity futures that we've ever seen in history, too. So this kind of manic retail buying pulled in futures traders, it pulled in volatility sellers, and it pulled in volatility targeting funds like risk parity and all this stuff. So we had this huge net long position going into mid-February, probably bigger than anything we've seen in a long, long time, if not ever before. And so when the virus hit, we had, you know, all this had to be unwound, and that's how you get the fastest correction in history. So it was really an amazing dichotomy to me to watch the fundamental deterioration, the deterioration breadth, and all these things that I was, you know, watching and mentioned in this economic predictors index and in those economically sensitive sectors. And at the same time, investors going crazy for the riskiest stocks in the market. It's euphoria like we haven't seen in a long, long time. So I think that this correction has kind of been the beginning of this unwind, but there's a lot of froth that's still out there. And I think it's very interesting. You mentioned there's a lot of traders that have only been involved in the market and only know it as a kind of a buy the dip market, that when the Fed comes in, it's time to buy. And there was a great article in Bloomberg last week where they polled a bunch of millennial investors about the mini crash that we saw last week. And they were all kind of saying things like, I can't wait. You know, I'm really glad now I have something I can tell my grandchildren about. You know, this, I never imagined the market could do this. And it just gives you some perspective on, you know, they think a 10%, 12% correction is a crash. It's their 1987. And the market is still extremely overvalued. And there's still, I don't think we've gotten to the point where you get to kind of panic and capitulation. I don't think we've gotten anywhere near that kind of bear market where you see the classic liquidation out of fear on the part of passive investors who believe themselves to be investing when they're really just speculating, as I wrote recently. So I do think the market's going to roll over probably at some point, and we will see that type of liquidation. And it will be come as a huge surprise to these investors that have only known a buy the dip kind of Fed-driven market.
Well, and I think that that mentality is very much in play right now. And again, listeners, remember, we recorded this on Monday afternoon, so it's a few days stale in terms of when you're listening to it. But at this time, the bottom so far in the S&P was 2875 late on Friday. We're back to about 3020 as we're speaking on Monday afternoon. And when I look on Twitter, there's all kinds of geniuses announcing, okay, you dummies, you know, that was 10% down. Anybody with a brain bought the dip. We're headed back to new all-time highs from here. It's all over. Everything has to get better from here because you had your 10% down, and we know that that's as bad as it gets. And, you know, to some extent, they've been right for the last 10 years. There's been very, very few corrections of more than 10%, and generally, buying 10% dips has made sense. It sounds like you're not in the camp that says the next move is to all-time highs. Would you agree with me that we've probably got some upside out of whatever the central bank response is, just because people are conditioned for that? But after that, what happens next? What do you see?
It's really difficult with these things to, I mean, you know, you have a game plan and you have to adjust your game plan. And after the 2018 sell-off, I actually took off a lot of hedges and, you know, around Christmas time, late 2018, but I started scaling back in, you know, spring of 2019, and I've had them on since. So I thought that 2019 rally was going to fail. And then the Fed came in with its liquidity injection and stocks pushed to all-time highs. So, you know, with that caveat out of the way, I do think I am looking for a failed rally. We could rally all the way up to, you know, 3187-ish, I think would be actually an ideal place for me to kind of put shorts back on again. And I have been scaling back in again today already. So, but it's really hard. Like I said, you have to have a game plan. My game plan is I'm looking for a failed rally because I do think this is only the beginning of a larger bear market, which will be driven by declining sales and earnings among, you know, the corporations and an unwind of this kind of speculative fever that we've seen. So that's my game plan. And that's pretty much all you can do is kind of go with it right here and watch kind of how it unfolds.
Jesse, something I've been saying for years is so long as the macro backdrop is deflationary, almost any problem central bankers can solve by just conjuring some more money out of thin air. It's when you get to secular inflation, and particularly a risk of runaway inflation, where it seems to me that's the end game, because that's where their hands are tied. They can't print more money, because if they do, doing so just exacerbates the inflation problem. Most people laugh at me when I even talk about that, because I guess in the minds of a lot of people, inflation is something that our grandparents remember, and you know, anybody who's cool knows that that hasn't been part of the market for decades now. I can't help as a student of history to know that these things are cyclical. It's coming back someday. Is that day anytime soon? What do you think? Do we need to be worried about inflation returning?
Well, I love hearing that, you know, people laugh when you talk about inflation. To me, that's a wonderful contrarian signal. I think it was, Bloomberg had a cover piece recently that, you know, asked, is inflation dead? It's another great, great signal. I think, you know, there was this short-term dichotomy in the market that I was just talking about before, where we saw investors acting as if things could not be better, right? They're buying more than ever before, getting super leveraged long, even while fundamentals were deteriorating in a dramatic way. That was a really interesting dichotomy that kind of unwound or began to unwind last week. I think there's a really another longer term, probably even a more important dichotomy than that. And that is that today, I mean, we're seeing the lowest interest rates in history. We're just over 1% on the 10-year note. So markets are clearly pricing in deflation, right? And they're actually pricing in deflation more than they ever have before. You know, real yields are as deeply negative as they've ever been. And at the same time, you're seeing some of the smartest investors on the planet start worrying about inflation. You see, I think Harley Bassman wrote an interesting piece recently. He puts out The Convexity Maven, and he wrote, "I'll stipulate that a fiat currency cannot be created at a faster rate than the growth of the economy without inflation. Over 5,000 years of collective civilization, we've seen no record of the sovereign printing the coin of the realm at such a pace without the currency becoming devalued. If such were the case, surely there would be legends of how poverty was eliminated with the wave of a hand." And you look at, just look at the growth of the money supply over a long period of time relative to the economy, just like Harley was mentioning. And you see that, you know, going back to 1970 or so, typically the money supply has been growing, but growing slower than the rate of the economy. And especially during the 1990s, the money supply was growing much slower than the economy. But since 2002-03, it started to jump up. And really in 2008-09, we saw the money supply grow 2 to 3% faster than the economy. And it even, you know, in 2015-16 got up to about 3.5% faster than the economy. So this is something that doesn't play out immediately. You don't see inflation immediately after this happens. But when it persists for a decade like this, it typically ends up in inflation. And, you know, I guess what's different today that makes this inflationary is it was really just the central bank, right, that was pursuing QE and printing money. But what we've seen since Trump took office is that the fiscal situation has deteriorated dramatically. We've seen, you know, we have now trillion-dollar plus deficits. This is really the first time in modern history we've had a widening fiscal deficit during an economic expansion. And so to me, we are already seeing modern monetary theory. We're seeing MMT right now. And that's why the Fed had to come in the markets and kind of rescue the money markets, because we're issuing so many treasury bills, the market cannot simply, you know, keep up with the supply of new debt out there. And so this kind of, I guess the way you would call it is fiscal dominance is I guess what economists would call it, where you get to the point where the fiscal authorities get so kind of out of control that the monetary authorities are forced into monetizing the debt in order to try and, you know, keep some calm in the money markets. It's exactly what we're seeing right now. So this is why Paul Tudor Jones in Davos was saying this is the craziest mix of fiscal and monetary kind of activity that we've ever seen in history. So you have, you know, a guy like Paul Tudor Jones saying you have the craziest mix in history. Harley Bassman talking about inflation is inevitably coming. He thinks, maybe a couple years out, 18 months out. You have Chris Cole, I think, who's recently on your podcast, talking about how investors have essentially positioned themselves more than ever they have in history, heavily invested into financial assets. And what is the risk? The greatest risk to financial assets is an inflationary episode. And so I think you hear a lot of smart people, Ray Dalio, talking about what happens when you get to monetary policy and fiscal, when you get to the zero lower bound. And this is why the Fed is desperate to try and create inflation, because when you get to the zero lower bound, they essentially run out of ammunition. They don't have a way to boost the economy anymore. And so this is why they're rethinking inflationary policy, trying to do whatever they can to boost inflation, because I think it's a couple of different reasons. One, it's to kind of give them some firepower back to deal with, you know, economic slowdown like we're seeing right now, but also because we're so massively and heavily indebted, not just on the sovereign side, but on the, like I mentioned earlier, the corporate America side, that, you know, the easiest way to kind of deal with those things is to try and inflate away the debt. So to me, this is a huge dichotomy. You see markets pricing in deflation, and the smartest guys, best investors on the planet are all talking about the risk of inflation and positioning themselves at least to be somewhat hedged against inflation going forward.
You know, you make a really important point, Jesse, which is although it comes in very, very different flavors from the different political parties, President Trump is clearly badgering the Fed, wanting lower interest rates, wants to borrow more money. And it's more, as you say, of sponsoring larger deficit spending. And it's in a particular category. I think the Democrats, if they were to take the presidency in November, have a very, very different agenda. It's much more about social spending, but they're definitely not going to spend any less than President Trump would have spent. One way or another, you're still getting to the point where eventually you have to face monetizing excessive deficit spending, whether it's MMT because Bernie has put Stephanie Kelton in as the new chair of the Fed, or if it's because President Trump is, you know, doing his thing. One way or another, it all leads in the same direction. The other aspect of this that nobody seems to talk about, Jesse, is if you look at things that happen in markets, you always turn to the guy who's been through it before. You look on those institutional desks for the real veterans that have seen it before. The guys who know about the onset of secular inflation either retired or died a long time ago. They're in their 90s now, because the last time that happened was the late 60s and early 70s. And those guys are not in the industry anymore. So I think we get to this situation where there's a return of inflation and the entire industry is kind of like, what? What do we do? And I don't know where that can take us other than potentially getting into a self-reinforcing vicious cycle where it tends to exacerbate and feed on itself. What do you think about the systemic risks of an entire industry facing a risk that it hasn't seen in 30 years?
Well, it's a huge deal. You have so much money. We see money is actually poured out of the equity markets. And I think that's just a demographic shift, people getting older and realizing they can't have, 80%, 90% exposure to equities, have to buy more bonds. But what people haven't been doing is putting more money into real assets. And that's really the case that Dalio makes, Christopher Cole makes in his recent paper, is that you have to have something in the portfolio that can do well in an inflationary environment. And the 60-40 portfolio, 70-30, that's really where problems can arise. Because if you get rising inflation and bond prices go down and so do stock prices, I mean, this is also how, you can see a pension crisis coming to the fore really quickly too. But, also to bring it back in terms of what we're seeing with the COVID-19 right now too, is that one of the things I believe is the greatest disinflationary force of the past 40 years was globalization. We saw the offshoring of labor and companies being able to cut labor costs and cut production costs and all these kinds of things by moving the production to China and other places overseas. And just in the last couple of years, through the trade war and things, we've seen this trend towards deglobalization. And now I think that is being exacerbated by this, what we're seeing with the virus. I mean, 90-some% of our antibiotics are made in China. And this is clearly a risk in this type of environment, that if they can't produce meds, then, that's a huge problem for the rest of the world. So I think there's a lot of people in Washington and across corporate America looking at what are the risks involved with this. Yes, it's boosted profits, but it creates a lot of other business risk and risk to health risk and all kinds of risks that we essentially didn't really analyze properly. And so to the extent that deglobalization is now, I guess, kind of, kicked into gear because of this COVID-19, that is an inflationary impulse over a long period of time, or at least it's an end to this disinflationary trend of globalization. So that's another facet of it too, that I think people are understanding that maybe this leads to deglobalization, but I don't think they understand that deglobalization is inherently inflationary.
I know from reading the Felder report that you've been focusing quite a bit on the fact that a lot of the greatest investors on the planet are preparing already for this regime shift towards secular inflation instead of deflation. How are they preparing? What are they doing? What's the change in asset allocation strategy to accommodate anticipation of this change?
Right. So I think the easiest one for investors is make sure you have some kind of allocation to gold. Ray Dalio has said, if you don't own gold, you don't know history. And I think that's probably the simplest way to explain it is whenever a country has gotten over indebted throughout history, we see inflation and a devaluation of the currency. And the best way to easiest way to protect yourself is through some type of real asset. I think gold is the easiest, but tips would also qualify, although they're not my favorite. And real estate probably to a certain extent does well, especially commercial real estate in an inflationary environment. But Christopher Cole's made some interesting points too about trend following and allocation to long volatility and an allocation to trend following. Anything that's not correlated to financial assets generally is a good idea, because financial assets are, just look at stock valuation since 1980, since inflation peaked, interest rates come down, valuations have gone straight up. Same thing with obviously with bond prices when interest rates have come down. So, financial assets generally do poorly in that type of thing. And so I think there's a lot of opportunities. And I think over the next 10 years, these things, are going to gain a lot more attention, systematic, long volatility, trend following, especially in things like commodities and currencies is going to be valuable. But I think gold is probably the easiest way to add some type of that diversification into the portfolio.
Jesse, there's always the possibility that maybe this is a buy the dip moment, at least for some issues. Is there anything that has happened in terms of this sell-off that creates a value play for you? I know you're very much a value investor. Is there anything that's actually a buy here?
I do think there are some opportunities, and it comes back to, I think one of the most popular things in the market right now is this ESG investing, and I do think it's pretty problematic for investors and for the markets. If you look at ESG funds, they're essentially tech funds. I mean, they're overweight tech and consumer discretionary, and so, they're obviously underweight things like energy. And so with money pouring out of actively managed funds and pouring into passive, but now even more so, I think the money that's flowed into ESG funds in 2019 was quadruple what, the 2018 inflows, and 2020 inflows are even on pace to be 2019. So essentially that means there's tons of money flowing into tech, which kind of goes along with that euphoric buying theme that I was talking about before. And energy is being left for dead. And to me, I think energy is one of the most interesting spaces right now for that reason. It is the lowest weighting in the S&P 500 I think it's ever been. There's all kinds of stats that show the opportunity in energy. I think for the first time, energy stocks now yield, or actually they're a lower weighting than utilities now in the S&P 500. Energy stocks yield tons more than the 10-year treasury note or even the 30-year bond. So I do think there's a terrific opportunity in energy right now. And I typically prefer the energy production companies. I think the exploration and production companies are the ones to focus on right now. Financial Times had an article about this, the positioning too. It's not just ESG money that's not putting money into energy. We're seeing, I think there's a lot of like algorithmic short selling in energy right now, because I think XOP and OIH, the two kind of energy ETFs that people would mainly focus on, have about at least 40% of their shares borrowed and sold short right now. So there's a huge short position in energy. I typically prefer, like I was saying, the oil and gas producers, because I think they're more of that straight play on the sector. I think the OIH, the service companies, I'm not quite as interested in, because there's been some good case made that shale is a bubble in the sector. And these service companies have benefited greatly from the expansion of drilling activity into shale. If shale companies, if we do run into, like I was mentioning before, some type of a Minsky moment in terms of the corporate debt bubble that we've seen, a lot of these shale companies are probably going to go bankrupt. That's not going to be good for the service companies, but it will probably be good for the producers that survive when you're taking supply out of the market from these other producers. So I think in 2000, during the dot-com mania, there were a lot of good value opportunities available when everybody just wanted to buy tech stocks. There were a lot of other companies that were left for dead. I don't think the situation is quite as dramatic today. There's still, even some of the cheapest stocks in the market are fairly expensive relative to history. But I think energy is one of those sectors in the market right now where there is true value.
Jesse, are there any other sectors besides energy where you see value opportunities?
Yeah. And, you know, just to kind of clarify too, that I'm looking for these types of value opportunities in the markets. I own some energy. I actually own a fair amount of energy and some of these other stocks that I'll mention, but I'm at least fully hedged against general market risk, if not net short right now, because of where I think we are in the broader, you know, market situation. But another area where I do think there is value is in retail. I think retail is another sector that has been massively shorted. A name that I've mentioned in other interviews is Bed Bath & Beyond. This is a stock that has just gotten absolutely pummeled and trades at an incredibly cheap valuation. It's not pricing in any of the potential rebound. They brought in a new CEO who was, you know, one of the top guys at Target who helped turn that business around and turn comps around. And so he's implementing the new strategy at Bed Bath & Beyond. The company has $1 billion in cash and literally no debt refinance needs in the next 10 years or something. So there's, you know, this is a company that I think, you know, if they're even able to stabilize sales trends, this stock could, you know, double or triple in price. And there are things like that here and there. Another stock that I'm looking at, believe it or not, and it kind of gives you an idea of how out of favor things are that I like to look at, is a company called Macerich, which is a shopping center REIT. And if you think, you know, what would be one of the stocks most hurt in a virus outbreak in the United States, is probably a company that operates shopping centers. But this stock was approached by Simon Property Group. They offered to buy this company for $100 a share, I think back in 2015 or 16. It now just traded under $20 today. So it's off 80% from the last place where they had a buyout offer from Simon. Over 80% of their malls are Class A malls. And I think Class A malls, even this retail apocalypse, Class A malls are going to do really, really well, because you have a lot of online retailers and things that want a physical presence, whether it's for, you know, order online, pick up at location, or return at a location. You have a lot of these online retailers that are opening physical stores and they want to do it in Class A malls. But this stock, I mean, has probably a net asset value of at least $50 a share, and it's trading under 20. You know, has a yield in the mid-teens, and there's been good insider buying, which is something I always look for in stocks. So it tells me that management doesn't think that this company's going to be in trouble anytime soon. They're in fine financial shape. It's just, I think, one of these situations where you have a company that stumbles for a little bit. It's in a pretty hated sector. You get some algorithm kind of, you know, trend following stuff to start shorting it super heavily. The short interest on this thing, you know, over the last 12 months has just exploded. Same thing with Bed Bath & Beyond. I think Bed Bath & Beyond is 70-80% of its float sold short. So the potential for short squeezes in these things is huge. Pretty much, you know, I look for opportunities like this, where if these companies just survive, the stock price is going to double or triple. And so I think there are a handful of these things out there right now. I look to try and own these kinds of things and hedge them against, like I said, the pretty serious general market risk I see out there.
Now, you just expressly acknowledged that, you know, if the virus outbreak gets worse, and I think it probably will, that that's going to put a lot of pressure on brick and mortar retail. So are you saying these are things to watch for a value play on a further dip later, or do you think that that's already priced in?
Yeah, I think it's already priced in. So I, you know, for me, one of my favorite examples is, you know, back during the BP Deepwater Horizon spill, towards the end of the spill, I was buying BP stock hand over fist, because to me, I was, you know, you look at what is the stock price, what is it pricing in right now? And BP was pricing in bankruptcy, like the stock was going to go out of business. And it makes sense, because you turn on the news anywhere, I think it was 2010 or 11, I can't remember specifically, but you turn on any news channel and 24/7, they were showing the underwater footage of oil just pumping into the Gulf. And so the sentiment against BP had become so extreme that it was pricing in the company going bankrupt. Now, if you had looked at, okay, what is the worst case scenario for BP? Let's look at all the different analysis. The worst case scenario for BP was that it was going to cost them $30 billion in damages and cleanup and whatnot. And that would probably be spread out over about 10 years. Well, take a look at BP's cash flow statement, and they were generating, I think, $30 or $35 billion a year in cash flow. So the company, out of 1 year's cash flow, could have paid off the entire liability of the spill. There was no possibility at all the company was going to go bankrupt. No chance at all, even in the worst case scenario. So for me, that's you know, these stocks, a stock like Mesa Rich is pricing in, you know, the virus hitting and shopping, you know, going nowhere and, you know, for a period of time. And all this kind of worst case stuff is already priced in at this stock price of $20 a share. You know, it's worth 50, 60. I can't even, it's not hard to imagine that Simon, you know, would come in and say, okay, we offered you $100, you know, 5 years ago. What do you say we buy the company for 50 today, you know, at half off sale, you know, and use this kind of distressed economic period driven by the virus as a chance to kind of buy something on the cheap. To me, absolutely. This is absolutely priced in. And so investors paying these prices today are getting a really good margin of safety in a stock like either Bed Bath & Beyond or Mesa Rich.
Jesse, before I let you go, you're best known perhaps for the Felder Report, which is one of the most respected newsletters in the industry. Tell us a little bit about that. And also, I know your podcast is kind of intermittent. It's not on a firm schedule, but tell us what's going on there as well.
Yeah, so with the newsletter, I basically write a weekly market comment. I do tons of reading during the week, and it's really focused on trying to understand what's really driving markets and where are the opportunities. And so that weekly market comment is focused on kind of what the trends that I'm seeing develop in the markets, like we talked about inflation and this euphoric buying. So I kind of outline that stuff in the market comments. And then the trade ideas, I have a kind of a pro version of the newsletter that where I come up with these trade ideas like Bed Bath and Mesa Rich. But the podcast is really kind of, you know, been, I guess, hit or miss lately in terms of been a lot of miss. I haven't had a lot of hits in terms of nailing people down to interview, but I try and do it more, you know, it's not so much on a news driven basis as more it is on a process driven basis. So I try and interview people when I find someone who I think has hit upon something in terms of their process that is unique and worth sharing with the audience. And so I maybe did 8 or 10 episodes last year, but I really try and focus on quality over quantity. And so for that reason, it's just not a regular thing. And I've tried to make it a regular thing, but it's just not, it's not to be. So, but it's been a blast doing it. And, I've had you on a couple times, Eric, which has been terrific. And, I've really enjoyed that.
Well, I've done lots of interviews with lots of people, and you're one of my favorites. So whenever you're ready to fire up the podcast again, just give me a shout and we'll find something to talk about. Meantime, we're going to need to leave it there. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was great to have Jesse back on the show. He's always been the voice of reason when it comes to how crazy the markets were in terms of valuations. And even when we had Francesco on last week talking about just the fragility of the markets, it's amazing to see it all coming together this way.
Yeah, I really enjoy Jesse. He's one of my favorite guys. But I want to keep things rolling, Patrick, and you've prepared another of your famous post-game chart books. Listeners, you'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email. It says Big Picture Trading Chart Book. This one is titled Where Next? Okay, Chief, what's next?
Right. And so I wanted to start it off all over Twitter. There's a number of people out there showing charts that show that when the Fed does an emergency 50 basis point rate cut, and especially a lot of them were referencing even when Bank of Canada follows with a 50 basis point cut, that the last time they've done this, both times were at the beginning of bear markets. And so I thought that was an interesting way to kind of build a storyline. And well, let's take a walk back in history to kind of look at how did the start of the bear markets look both in 2000 and 2008? So I wanted to just start off with chart number two. On chart two, it's going back to 2000, 2001. And what it shows is that once that sell-off began in September of 2000, we spent about a month declining about 15% from the top to bottom. And when a short-term swing low happened, you had about a 10% rally off of the low over about 19 days. And that was truly the transition from where buyers buy dips and take the market to higher highs to a period where once the initial sell-off began, rallies became opportunities for sellers to sell. And we transitioned that began a multi-year bear market. On chart three, we have the 2007-2008 chart. And what we have is off of that 2007 October high as well, we had a stock market that plunged about 11.5% off of its high and then bounced, rallying about 8.5% over 10 days. And again, in the same scenario, that was the moment that transitioned the market from the buy on dip traders buying all the dips to the now all rallies are being sold. And I thought that was an interesting way of kind of putting an analog on top of the existing market to really kind of get a grasp as to what we're going through and what could happen next. And so on page four, what we have is the chart today. And what's amazing, and going back to Francesco's fragility comments or even Chris Cole's volatility comments, I mean, we had one of the largest 5-day market drops. I mean, I think you have to, was it going back to 1929 to get a drop of similar magnitude? But we lost 16% in 5 days, right, Eric? And what's amazing is that we got a bounce, and the bounce was about 10% over 4 days. What's amazing is the speed of which this is happening. And the question now is, will we see that pattern that happened in 2000 and 2007 repeat itself, which is that every rally is sold? Are we going to see that every time the market pops, now sellers that are way leveraged and long too much equity will use the strength to immediately distribute into, right?
Well, Patrick, I couldn't agree more that we are in almost certainly the beginning of a very significant bear market. But I think it's important to point out, if we go back to page three, which is the 2008 event, okay, you had the very smartest people, super smart people, were, you know, in 2005 and 2006, had this all figured out and they knew what was coming. But it wasn't really until the spring of 2007 that mainstream financial people started to realize, hey, wait a minute, we got this whole subprime mortgage-backed securities complex that there's a lot of paper that's just not worth what its theoretical price is. We've got serious collateral issues. Something is broken here. And it was a situation where there's nothing actually wrong with any of those houses. They weren't on fire or anything. What was wrong was that collateral had been mispriced. A whole bunch of people got suckered into buying these complex derivatives that they didn't understand, that they didn't really know that the AAA ratings on those securities were not warranted. It was too confusing to sort out. And boy, it led to a really big crisis, which was financial by its very nature. There wasn't an earthquake that caused a whole bunch of homes to be damaged, and so the homes weren't worth anything and they had to be sold. It was financial in its nature. It was the financial system that was badly broken, really, I think, as a result of a lot of regulatory failures and a lot of very mispriced securities due to collateral failure. What we're looking at now is a situation where you've got a global pandemic. The smartest people figured this out in early January. I figured it out in late January. And it seems to have taken the market until now to figure out that, yeah, it's real. It's not just China that can go through this. The things that happened in China, maybe not quite on as bad of a scale as Wuhan, because at least we can see it coming to some extent, whereas they didn't know what had hit them. But if you look at what's happened to Daegu, South Korea, you know, that's going to happen all around the world. The cat's out of the bag. We're not immune because we're American and we're exceptional or anything. It's going to happen to us too. And you're already seeing the breakouts in Europe really happen. What this means is that necessarily it's going to require that people distance themselves from other people. They're going to have to avoid big gatherings and so forth. They're going to have to avoid mass transit wherever possible. They're going to have to avoid being exposed in crowded places to lots of other people, which particularly in densely populated cities is really hard to do, especially if your income is dependent on riding the New York City subway every single day. So it's a very, very different driver behind this. I think that it makes sense to expect everything to happen faster, because what we've got right now, you look at on page 4, this great big super scary looking drop, 16%, and I don't know how many days was that, 7 or 8 trading days that we went down 16%, and now we're back up 10%. Read Twitter, Patrick, and listen to the news. Most people will still tell you it's just the flu, it's not a big deal, only elderly people have to be concerned, which is just utterly crazy. Anybody who's been paying attention knows that we're dealing with something much, much worse than that. So I think the next big move down, especially if Europe breaks out next week the way that I think it does, and particularly if more locations around the United States, not just Seattle, but also New York State, and now we've got maybe Nevada also. If this is all over the United States and it's all over Europe by the end of next week and people finally wake up to what should have been obvious a month ago, I think the next leg down could be a lot bigger than 16%.
Well, it's important to also put into context, though, Eric, is just what levels are the turn points. I like to look at the markets in a very neutral state to kind of get a pulse on what is the path of least resistance. And the price action tells you a very important story. And on page 5, I thought it's important to put into context not only what we're witnessing in terms of the average volatility, but where is the kind of neutral zone where if the bulls can somehow muster a save on this and it doesn't end up being this bear market that we're talking about, what would we have to see for that narrative to start to develop? And it's important to just give it lip service. So that way, at least we can say, well, because it didn't happen, then the bear market narrative is still the one that is the dominant one. And what's interesting, I put on here, I mean, there's obviously some great work from Charlie McElligott and Brent from Spot Gamma that basically talk about these levels where dealer exposure is on the options market. And we continue to be in what's known as the high volatility zone. And just to put this in context of what high volatility zone defines, I mean, since the first breakdown day of the market, these 8 days that encompassed this market crash and bounce, what we have witnessed is the average daily range, high-low range of 146 S&P points. Right. And it's just amazing to see such huge volatility. No wonder the VIX is north of 30 and sometimes spiking 40 plus. When you have this kind of daily ranges, that's the right price of volatility when you have these kind of swings. And what's contributing to that is dealer hedging, because when we are under the gamma flip zone, dealers have to be hedging their exposure by actually going with the direction of the market. So then when the market is rallying, dealers are buying, adding to the buying pressure. And then when the market is selling, the dealers are selling with the selling to exacerbate the selling pressure. And so you have this scenario where this high volatility zone, it's the dominant area in the market. And we would need a market to rally north of 3250, really, for us to see everything calm right down. Otherwise, this volatility is here to stay.
I think this volatility is here to stay, and it could always be a little outlier event, but barring something big, I think that the top of this correction is probably in and that we're headed lower from here.
All right. Well, on page 6, what I wanted to just share was just overlaying the two drops that happened after the bounce in both 2000 and 2008. And I kind of drew on here just what happened next in both of those bear market moves. After the market bounce, it proceeded in the following 6-7 weeks to drop 12 to 16% in a second leg lower. And so that, and not necessarily being a forecast, but rather something for us to kind of keep a close eye on to see whether the market follows that along. If it played out the same as it did in 2000 and 2008, then as this market rolls over here, that drop should take the S&P down to about 2600 to 2700 range, give or take, out into April. And so it'll be really interesting to see whether or not the market works lockstep with that kind of an analog.
You want to bet it goes below 2600 before the end of March?
Well, all right. Well, if you want to make a bet, we can. I'm always up for a bet, as you know.
I am not, no matter what happens in the market, I am not wearing the clothing that Kevin Muir is wearing for any risk, any price.
So you're not a betting man then, for sure. No, but
not on that bet. That is scary.
The Huddle menswear is an important thing. But anyway, the point though being is that look, there's always a chance we go south of 2600. Actually, if it is a bear market, we are going way lower than that. But in the past bear markets, what we've seen, like for instance, if you go to 2008, even though the S&P 500 wiped out more than 50% of its value, it actually happened in three separate drops. And the real drop in the markets, the September-October 2008 event, happened almost 9 months after the start of the bear market. And so while I do think that if we are in a bear market, we could see levels much lower than 2,600, I do think, though, that it probably won't happen all at once. I mean, you're in that camp. I think that a bear market is a prolonged process of distribution. And even if we go there, it probably will be something that lasts throughout the summer and even further than that.
Well, I just want to counter so that we'll see what happens. We'll come back, folks, and at the end of March, whatever our last show is in March or our first show in April, we will do an update on this. But I agree with you. In a financial bear market being driven by financial conditions, those things are true. Now, my projections, which could be totally wrong, they're just based on current case count growth. If let's go to the 31st, well, I don't have the 31st of March. I have the 30th of March, by which time my conservative estimate shows 389,000 cases of COVID-19 in Europe alone. If that is anywhere close to true, we're going to be below 2,600 on the S&P. Now, I could easily have gotten the COVID, you know, I'm not an epidemiologist. This is not my field. I'm learning as much as I can about it as quickly as I can. Maybe I've got it all wrong. But if my case count projections and pandemic projections are remotely close to true, by the end of March, we're going to be in a real pickle that's going to be a lot worse than 2,600 on the S&P.
All right, Eric, let's go to chart 7, where we have the weekly chart on crude oil going all the way back to 2016. I really wanted to capture that low near $26 onto this chart. What also our listeners can see that have the chart book downloaded can see that 42 level and how important it is in terms of how many times it was tested throughout this period. I really think that this could be a huge psychological level. I think there's a lot of traders that are holding on to some of these energy contracts on the hope that 42 holds the line. It really could be a psychological breakpoint if we see a legitimate break of 42, because that could create a feedback loop mechanism that causes capitulation selling that could really downdraft oil very quickly. What's your take on that?
My take on that is a whole bunch of both April and May, mostly May, crude oil puts. So I'm putting my money where my mouth is. But I would have said before this pandemic situation, 42 spot 36, that's your low. Buy the dip, baby. If we can get that again, it's got to be all uphill from there because, you know, look at the chart. You can see how well that's held. We've got a different equation here, folks. And if you've got everybody afraid to leave their house because they don't want to catch this thing, it completely changes demand expectations. And you can't even get Russia to agree to a production cut of 1 million barrels. Well, what's going to happen when you need a production cut of 10 million barrels? We've got a lot of downsides still to come. Now, certainly, if I have the virus story wrong, nobody's right about everything. If I've got this whole COVID-19 thing wrong, and it's about to blow over and everybody's going to get better and there's not going to be a big pandemic breakout and the U.S. is not going to get it and one of President Trump's miracles saves the day, then 42 spot 36, that's got to be the bottom and we're not going below that. If I'm right about the virus, I think 26 spot 08 is entirely plausible. And there's a couple of technical levels on the way down. 32 is a fib zone. I forget which fib it is, but there's a couple levels in there. But I think it's entirely possible that we could get back down to 26.08, the 2016 low.
All right, Eric, I wanted to move on to pages 8 and 9, where we have the gold charts. I wanted to just talk about the current gold conditions, but you asked me to add this weekly gold chart going back from to 2007 to 2010. What is it that you wanted to point out here?
Well, let's remember, we'll have to mentally superimpose an S&P chart on top of this. The stock market topped out, folks, in October of 2007. So from October 2007, as the stock market was coming down, people got it. They understood that we were at the beginning of a problem. And I remember a lot of the commentary and reading it at the time and trading gold and being long gold in the end of 2007 and making a lot of money on it. And you made money and you made money and you made money and you made money right up until things started to really get serious in 2008. And what was going on was all through that entire crisis, the whole thing was very bullish for gold fundamentally because you knew it was going to result in more central bank accommodation. They were going to have to print money. They're going to have to debase the currency. It had to be good for gold. And people knew that. And then they got caught wrong-footed. Why? Because in a crisis, when you've got the stock market, not in a bear market drifting down, but crashing, what happens is people are facing margin calls. They have to sell their gold even though they don't want to because they've got to meet a margin call. And when you get to July of 2008, when things really started to get interesting, then you see there's an acceleration in the downside in gold and then it kind of recovers. You get into October, which is when things really, really got ugly and gold got hammered. Why? Because the stock market wasn't drifting down in a gentle bear market. It was crashing, and people had to meet margin calls, and they had to sell their gold. And the crazy thing was, all the events that were going on were super bullish for gold. And that's the reason in October or early November, I forget which, of 2008, gold bottomed long before stocks did. And once the really, really sudden and extreme margin call inducing moves were over in the S&P, gold bottomed and it was all uphill from there right up to that blow-off top in 2011 where we got, gold had it almost tripled in price at that point. The reason that I'm spending so much time on this, Patrick, is I think we're about to have the same thing happen again. Everything that's happening right now is super duper bullish for gold long term. If we have the kind of a stock market crash that I think is possible, given the coronavirus situation, we could have a repeat of the same kind of action you see here through September and October of 2008, where despite the fact that it's good fundamental news, it's crashing the price of gold. And the thing is, this is the best kind of downside. You know, the kind of downside you don't want in a market when you've bought something is, oh, I got the fundamentals wrong. And gee, I screwed up. I bought the wrong thing and I've lost my money and I'm not going to get it back. But when you've got an asset like gold, where the fundamentals are just getting better and better, but the reason they're getting better and better is because a crisis is happening, which is causing gold itself to get sold off. It means when that bottom comes in, it's an incredible buying opportunity. I think that what we saw in the last few weeks, where there was a really sharp sell-off in gold, and then it all very quickly came back up, I think that was a dress rehearsal for a much bigger event where we're going to have a bigger downside in stocks. It's going to cause more margin calls. It's going to cause more forced selling of gold, even though the fundamentals for gold are better than ever. That's going to be an incredible buying opportunity. Now, how the heck do you pick the bottom? I don't know. Nobody knows. Maybe we'll try to find somebody who does know and get them on the show. But at some point, when that bottom occurs, it creates an incredible buying opportunity. So my point is, keep some dry powder. Be ready for gold to go on sale. And it doesn't mean the fundamentals are bad. It means the fundamentals are better than they were before. It's going to be a terrific opportunity. Now, there's a possibility that that never happens just because in markets, history doesn't repeat because people learn from the last one. Maybe what will happen is people will, as it goes down, it won't go as much down because everybody says, remember 2008, it went down at first, but it ended up going up super after that. I'm going to go ahead and jump into gold here. Maybe it won't sell off as hard as it did in 2008 just because the lesson of 2008 was not forgotten. So that's a potential caveat. Aside from that, though, I think we're maybe setting up here for a big move down followed by an even bigger move up.
Well, on page 9, I've got the weekly chart of gold right now, and I have a little bit of a different opinion. I mean, that's what makes a market. I personally think that the price action on gold has been incredibly strong, and it continues to behave very, very well. I mean, that sell-off that we saw and the immediate recovery when the 50 basis point cut came in is just showing the aggressive accumulation, and it's because it's becoming a reality that central banks are going to be funding some sort of a big fiscal spend at the end of this. The helicopter money term is being thrown around quite a bit. I think there's a lot of people reaching for gold as a diversifier in their portfolios. On this chart, a lot of the measured moves go out to about 1750, but now that we're up this high, it's hard to imagine, not imagine, gold making it all the way back to those 1800 and 1920 kind of highs. And so maybe what the scenario happens is that on the interim in the coming months, gold punches still higher to test those zones, and then some meaningful mean reverting correction happens off of a major test along those highs.
That's entirely possible. And I'm so glad you said that, Patrick, because I want to make absolutely sure that people don't misinterpret my previous comments. I am not saying by any stretch that there has to be a move down in gold. Like I said, it could be that people are smart enough to remember 2008, know that everything that's happening right now is super bullish for gold, and it never sells off at all. So don't sell all your gold because I told you it was going to go down. I told you it might go down. What I am saying with very strong conviction is if it goes down and goes down a lot, that's an incredible buying opportunity. It didn't go down a lot because it's a bad asset and you don't want to own it. It went down a lot because the fundamentals actually got better the way they did in 2008. And if you can figure out where the bottom is, you just want to buy like crazy. So I'm not saying it has to happen, but if it does happen, don't think it's time to forget gold. It's time to double down and go big time into gold. Just have some dry powder ready if that happens. But Patrick, we may not know exactly which way it's going to go. What I do know with absolute certainty is tomorrow, that is Friday, the 6th of March, you are doing a live volatility trading webinar where you're actually going to give people a chance to watch you putting on the trades we've talked about in the last couple of weeks, post-game segments live, so you can show them exactly how it's done in your trading system. Now, I'm going to anticipate, since people sometimes listen to the show over the weekend, they might have missed it by the time they're hearing our voices right now. If people missed your webinar on the 6th, if they sign up as members at bigpicturetrading.com, will it be possible to get a replay after the fact?
Absolutely. So it is still going to be available as a recording to any of our paying members. And so I'm looking forward to doing it. And when we started and got inspired to do this, when Chris Cole was on the show, the markets were actually pretty calm. And it was actually an environment where putting on long vol trades was incredibly easy. What's going to be really fun with this webinar is now that volatility has exploded and the markets have moved so much, it actually dynamically changes the payoff profiles of putting on many of these trades in this conditions. And so it's going to be really good to, in that live environment, dissect at least why there's not so much of a asymmetry in putting on those trades, what you would need to see to go long volatility in these conditions. Lots of really fun stuff. If you missed, again, the live webinar, if you still want to see it, the recording will be available for all of our paying members. And just go to bigpicturetrading.com and sign up for a monthly membership, and you'd get access to it anytime after we do the live recording. Recording tomorrow.
This episode was made possible by TopTradersUnplugged.com. Remember to get the ultimate guide to the best investing books ever written at TopTradersUnplugged.com/macro guide. For information on sponsoring Macro Voices, please visit macrovoices.com/sponsor info. Listeners, be sure to register a free account at macrovoices.com. The benefit to you is you'll receive our Research Roundup email, which provides you with all of the best free content that we could find on the internet each week, including downloads associated with our guest appearances, as well as, of course, our post-game chart books. Patrick, tell them what they missed in this week's Research Roundup.
This week, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview with Jesse, as well as a link to the charts we just discussed in the postgame. Also, you'll find a link to Jesse Felder's recent blog article titled putting the fastest correction in history into context, and a Bloomberg article with a transcript of Russell Napier's current market perspectives are all included in this week's Research Roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we will include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend and myself at Patrick Ceresna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the Internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.